from the halls of every school in Michigan, this is School Talks on 760 WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy. Sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran Real Point, Collins and Plaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, and by Clark Construction. Now, take your seats. Class is in session. Here's Robert.
For the program today, I start with a question to our listeners. Have you ever received an email or a text message from your department store credit card or maybe your bank that your information has been part of a data breach? If so, this is the program for you. We're joined by cybersecurity expert Shai Hardin and from Warren Consolidated Schools, Director of Information Systems Nick Petroni. All this and more coming up. This is School Talks on 760 WJR.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now in the program is Shai Hardin from Cyber Protect LLC. The topic of discussion today is something I think we're all familiar with, and that is hacking and cyber attacks and people's emails being hijacked and all kinds of things happening out in the universe as it relates to technology. And Shai's joining us today to give us a good, solid understanding of how cyber hacking works and eventually the trickle-down that has on organizations, especially schools. So welcome to the program, Shai.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yep. So first off, what are the most common types of cyber hacking methods used today?
The most common are still phishing. Emails, spear phishing is becoming very big. Ransomware attacks, zero-day attacks, supply chain, where you're attacking somebody else outside of your organization, but they're the weak link in the chain, and they move up into your organization through them.
I see. And the term spear phishing is where someone sends you an email or some type of communication that sort of looks like something from the organization.
Spear phishing is tailored a little more towards you. So say there was a data breach and your information was stolen in there. They're going to take that information and craft a message specifically for you to trick you using your name, your address, some information about you.
I see. And so the term spear is to give the impression that it's a very accurate attack towards someone, particularly based on them having access to your information.
Correct.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So as cyber hacking continues seemingly happening everywhere, you hear about, as you mentioned, data breaches for lots of places, department stores and hospitals and all kinds of things. Specifically, how does the concept of ransomware work? And are there any particular stages to a typical ransomware attack?
There are. If you're a bad guy, the first thing you want to do is do reconnaissance on your target. You want to find out who they are, where they are, give as much information as you can. Next, you're going to work on infiltrating their network. You're going to find different ways to get in. Maybe it's spear phishing. Maybe it's loading up malware on a USB stick and dropping it in a parking lot, you know, at their building. And that person takes it in and goes and plugs it into their computers. So infiltration is next. But then after you get in, you don't want to get bumped out. So you need to move laterally through the network and maintain persistence. So if you're caught somewhere, you're going to go ahead and just open up one of those other channels and get back into the network. But you're going to try to be as quiet as possible during this whole thing. And you're going to observe. And then you're going to try to raise your privileges. Maybe you're just a normal user, and you're going to get your privileges raised to an administrator, a domain admin, a global admin, could be even an email admin. And then finally, after you've been sitting there for a while, being quiet, then that's when you deploy your payload and attack the network. Maybe it's ransomware. Maybe you're trying to get in the middle of financial transactions and have money siphon off to a bank account that you control.
Wow. So this has the makings of some type of spy movie. Just to recap what you said, there's reconnaissance, infiltration. Once you're in, you move laterally, you observe, you maybe increase your privileges within the network to maybe an administrative level, and then you deploy. I mean, this is quasi-military, at least in terms of language.
It really is.
Yeah, and it's fascinating that those stages, it almost feels very linear in terms of getting to where you want to go before you deploy and eventually, in this case, request ransom for access to the network. So in your experience at CyberProtect LLC, we're currently with Shai Hardin, a technology expert with CyberProtect LLC. What industries, in your experience, are most frequently targeted by ransomware attacks, and why do you think that is?
Well, education, of course, healthcare, construction, legal, banking and financial services are the big ones. The main reason is these industries can pay. They have the financial resources, they have insurance, they most likely have cyber insurance even. If they're doing the right things, the bad guys are going to get their money. They want a payday at the end of the day is why they do all of this.
And these organizations, aside from insuring themselves, are there any particular steps that they could take to reduce the risk?
There are. A lot of things that they can do is patching. Patching their systems and keeping them up to date will probably cut down many of the attacks that are possible.
And a patch, is that sort of a software update that stays ahead of anyone trying to get in the system?
Correct. Those patches are going ahead and updating the systems, the drivers, the security, all kinds of portions of that piece of software. But patching is one of the things that you really need. Next is endpoint security. You used to have antivirus back in the day, and now it's kind of graduated to endpoint security, managed endpoint detection or extended detection and response, and zero trust security. After that, you want to make sure you have good backups. You want to test those backups and make sure you are recoverable. And lastly, education. As in, you know, anything, education is key. So if you're educating your staff, your employees, your higher-ups, to recognize phishing, recognize when language is kind of off in an email, when I wasn't expecting, this is a weird document.
Right.
You know, I'm not supposed to open documents that I don't know from somebody. So these are really good things to start with, good basics.
Yeah, you know, in my own personal experience and with many people with whom I've worked over the years, when you're busy at work, it's easy to fall into a trap where you're going through 30 or 40 emails just trying to clear them out, and one of them happens to be a phishing attempt. You know, you're just in the mode of getting stuff off your desk, and all of a sudden you have given up the ship by responding to something or opening a particular file. So you mentioned training. Do you, through your company, provide employee training and preventing ransomware attacks?
We do. We provide a platform where every week we're putting out new short videos, kind of entertaining, right? Trying to gamify it also so that maybe the names of the individuals is obfuscated so people can't tell who's doing well and who's not doing so well in their cybersecurity training. But you'll know your name, you'll see where you're at in that list and see how good you're doing answering some of the questions after those videos. Doing an annual training, doing some AI training in there even, and learning about, you know, how AI can be used to trick you.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. AI is another entire world. But Shai Hardin, I want to thank you so much for joining us. You've given our listeners a lot to think about, especially as it relates to technology and through our lens, eventually schools. So I appreciate the work you do with CyberProtect LLC, and we're most certainly going to have you back on the program because I imagine at some point there's going to be another attack somewhere. So keep up the good work, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, sir.
Coming up after a word from our sponsors, we'll be joined by Nick Petroni, Director of Information Systems for Warren Consolidated Schools. Stay right there. We'll be right back.
This- This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy, sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran Real Point, Collins and Blaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, and by Clark Construction. Once again, at the head of the class, Dr. Livernoy.
Joining us now on the program is Nick Petroni, Director of Information Systems for Warren Consolidated Schools. Welcome to the program, Nick.
Thank you. Honored to be here.
So in our focus on this program about all things related to cyber attacks and ransomware and so on, in your experience working in a very large school system, how have cyber attacks and ransomware affected school districts, either in your own experience or in what you may have heard from your peers in the business?
Well, it's been a very accelerating topic in education and in IT. Maybe 10 years ago, you'd have an antivirus that would compromise a system or a computer, but now ransomware is growing at a very fast pace, and local districts, even local to us, have been victim of ransomware attacks, which take down their systems entirely.
And you're speaking of other school districts in the area, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
So, and why do you think, in your role, why are school districts considered attractive targets for cyber criminals?
Well, the size of the districts, the importance of the operational status of the district, the data that we keep, and the financial support. The financials of the district would be potentially an avenue for a scammer or an attacker to be paid through.
Sure, and you mentioned financial. Any thought as to what the typical cost, either financial or otherwise, maybe in people's time, a ransomware attack could have on a school district?
It's easily thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, if not in the millions, depending on the severity of the attack, the time it takes to restore, or mitigate or bargain with the attackers.
You know, and when you watch the news and you hear about a cyber attack of, maybe a large department store or this or that, they often talk about the fact that there's ransom and the progress and so on. And often they don't actually get into the disruption caused, such as to day-to-day operations or, the ability for the company to continue to operate. And in your experience with schools, that type of disruption, how would that affect a school operation if it, in fact, was disrupted?
Sure. Depending on the severity, but if your systems were locked out, I would imagine that would cancel school until you have that resolved. If you think about the systems it would affect, it could be your physical security. It could be the health reporting, your attendance reporting, your communication to parents, teachers. And with those, with the importance of those systems in place today, I don't think you can have school functional without proper systems in place.
And here I thought a snow day was a big deal. What are the primary vulnerabilities in a school district's IT infrastructure? I remember back in the day, all school districts had these, I used to call them ICE station zebra rooms with all the servers and whatnot. But what are the vulnerabilities in a school district's IT area that attackers try to exploit specifically?
Well, outside of the physical network itself, you have a basic network's going to have a firewall and antivirus or endpoint protections in place, and that's a given nowadays. But it has to be advanced, and you have to have potentially an AI function to that to watch out for zero-day attacks and whatnot. But the biggest avenue is probably the people.
Mm-hmm.
With close to 2,000 staff members and 13,000 students, that's a lot of different people that can be attacked and create vulnerabilities for your network.
And, when technology first came into schools, I remember this vividly, everyone at one point or another in the 90s had a computer lab installed, right? It was this static lab with really big monitors and so on. And that was the extent of the technology. And you raise an important point that 13,000 people, 2,000 staff, students, they're all coming into the district and they're all bringing with them their own technology.
Correct. Mobile technology, either assigned or brought. And that controlled environment that you defined with a computer lab was really nice for our technicians and staff because it's a controlled environment. We knew what was on them, who used them, when they used them. Now, with a wireless network and the instructional learning practices in place, we have to protect all the mobile devices.
It's a completely different animal, especially all those devices coming in and out of the schools every day. They're individually subject to all their own updates and whatever viruses they're containing coming in and out of the network.
Absolutely.
Seems like a big traffic jam. So we're currently with Nick Petroni, the Director of Information Systems with Warren Consolidated Schools, talking about cybersecurity and ransomware. So, Nick, are there any specific cybersecurity challenges right now on your desk that affect you and other K-12 schools compared to other industries?
Probably the biggest challenge is kind of finding that balance between convenience and security. I can have the most secure network by unplugging it, but that's not very convenient. So finding that balance is probably the biggest task, because in the curriculum that we have, there are many websites that teachers use, students use. They're free websites, and they all have different logins or data that's going to be flowing. And so trying to have everything locked down but allow instructional curriculum at the same time is that ongoing challenge that we're going to face.
And the way you describe that, that is a pretty complex set of moving targets. And unplugging is easy, right? But
correct.
The minute you plug it in, so begins all of this interaction between devices and people. So given the size of the district, and I think it, in one lens, the size of the organization is independent, but what steps have you taken to prevent cyber attacks and ransomware incidents in the school district? What are some really specific strategies you've employed?
Well, I like to say reduce risk. So, we do our best to reduce risk. We have an advanced firewall in place with the active subscription of many different threat and URL filtering protections in place that's ongoing. On top of that, we have a good endpoint protection on all our staff devices, our student devices, and we have a good VPN access that all works together with our firewall to make sure that all our devices are protected.
Mm-hmm. And the VPN, the virtual private network, as it's called, is that sort of like a network within a network?
Pretty much like a tunnel to our network.
Okay.
So it really works on our endpoint devices for students and staff. And if they're at home or off of our network, it's still getting our policies in the network.
Yeah. So we're currently with Nick Petroni. I'd like to take a short break, hear from our sponsors. When we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit about how districts recover and some of the budget and resource implications of trying to keep things safe. So stay with us. We'll be back right after this.
School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
We're back here with Nick Petroni, Director of Information Systems for Warren Consolidated Schools, talking about cybersecurity, ransomware, and just the whole world of technology, attacks and vulnerabilities. And there's so much to talk about. I wanted to ask you, Nick, how do you ensure that staff and students are trained to recognize whether they might be being set up or attacked, or I think the term is phishing or phished.
Fished, yeah.
How do you train them?
Well, at the start of every school year, every staff member anyway has to go through a training seminar video that kind of goes through all the different things to look out for. But in addition to that, in the past we have done phishing campaigns by the district through a third party. And basically what we do is emulate a phishing email, a common one that happens in the day, and we'll send that to our staff, and we'll have to put allowances on our email security to bypass our own filters and whatnot that would normally try to catch that. And then we'll see if staff members click on it, if they open it, if they fall for an email, if they respond to it. And each one of those actions, if they do fall for it, gives them a training opportunity or what they could look out for. And we try to indicate things like watch the date and the to and the sender and the subject and do you know this person? Are you expecting an email? And all the different flags that go with that type of attack.
And, you know, my favorite one in this example is the sender, because it might look like it's coming from a reputable source. But the minute you drill down on the sender email, it's usually, I think this is a technical term, it's a whole bunch of gobbledygook before the at symbol, and then it's somebody with a Hotmail account.
Mm-hmm.
Or, but the way they mask that by saying it's from, you know, the superintendent's desk or whomever, is really part of the whole phishing campaign. As I mentioned, the notion of someone having to check 20, 30, 40 emails in a day to get caught is It's not that difficult, just given you're trying to move stuff off your desk and so on.
Yeah, it's very easy, and we try to be, we work with our staff, so we want them to come forward if they think they are, and we use it as a training opportunity in itself.
Sure. Does the district have a, I guess we'd call this a disaster recovery or a backup plan in place in the event of something happening? Well, I imagine you're backing up your data, but is there some element to a recovery plan?
Yeah, we have some triggers that would, you know, be enacted if an attack did happen, and we do have that disaster recovery plan in place that would look at our backups. We do testing. We'd contact our cybersecurity insurance, that kind of thing, depending on the type of attack.
Mm-hmm. And from a financial perspective, how does the district allocate, especially in technology, its budget for cybersecurity?
As far as the district goes, I've been very supported, and I'm very lucky to say that, and so is the district itself, having some allocation out of our general fund to put towards cybersecurity initiatives. I'd say over the past 10 years, the budget has probably grown tenfold for appliances and software and education on these attacks. But the funding from the state really hasn't increased. So it's more of a partnership I have with our business office, cabinet and superintendent, as well as the community has been very supportive through bond passings and whatnot.
And the term you're referring to quite often in industries that don't get enough money through one channel or another is the reallocation of resources.
Absolutely.
And I must take this opportunity for our School Talks listeners to share with you what I think is probably one of the most unique things that happened to me in my career. And for full disclosure, Nick and I worked together for many, many years. He, in his role as information systems director, worked directly for me when I was superintendent. And I remember vividly the night the governor shut the state down due to the pandemic. I called Nick at home about midnight, and I said, Nick, when you get into work tomorrow morning, I want you to call Dell Computers and purchase 10,000 or 12,000 computers instantly. And his response to me was, are you serious? I said, yeah, because we're going to need them. And through your efforts and our commitment and from the support of the Board of Education, we were one of the first districts in line to get laptops, which made us that much farther ahead than others at trying to educate children at home, knowing the state was going to be shut down. Now, the full disclosure is once you buy them, you have to maintain them. Mm-hmm. And that really, much like the growth of cybersecurity, is really how budgets expand. And it's not very pretty. It's not a lot of window dressings and whatnot. But as technology threats expand, much like buying 10,000, 12,000 computers, with that too comes the maintenance, the update, and the continued monitoring of that. And in this lens, keeping the district safe. So just a side note that I thought was worth noting. So Nick, on the technology sort of trends perspective, what technologies or tools have you found to be the most effective at heading off these types of attacks?
Well, outside of our firewall, and I'll keep saying that because we're attacked every second of every day, and through bots and whatnot. But probably the biggest, I'll call it the game changer, is an AI email filter that we put into place a couple of years ago. So we were constantly getting hit with spoofing attacks, like you mentioned earlier. It'd be someone that would imitate the superintendent, but the email address would be, you know, MrSuperintendent@gmail.com. And it would trick so many people because they're looking on their phones and they wouldn't see the email address. And one person would fall for it, and that the bad actor would get in, and they'd use that account then to do it again and again and again. So we were constantly losing the battle. Not really the battle, but if you have 2,000 staff members and you have a big phishing attack or spoofing attack on your network, say you got 1,900 of them did not fall for it, you still had 100 people fall for it, which is a substantial number and data in those accounts. So we went and looked at an advanced AI email filter that looks at anomalies or looks at senders that are routine, or if it's someone that's blanketing everyone all at once, and it uses some algorithms to stop or restrict or flag emails before they happen. Mm-hmm. And it'll actually now remove an email from people's mailboxes if it deems so necessary.
And you know, the whole idea of protecting the district, I think, really comes down to the data that districts are required to keep and collect, extremely private data on students and even to an extent staff, makes what you're doing arguably one of the most important features of the organization, given for our School Talks listeners, there's a law, the Federal Education Rights Privacy Act, which has an entire set of rules as to how you're required to manage student data that might be private, whether it's related to their health, their disability, any of the stuff that's ultra private, much like the privacy you would expect when your doctor has your medical records, that is put upon school districts. We know it as FERPA, the acronym for the Federal Education Rights Privacy Act, but it goes to the point of how much you're actually responsible for when one of these bad actors finds his or her way into school. And it really sheds light on how important this is to the overall smooth operation of the district. So I want to thank you very much for joining us on the program today. Keep up the good work, and as I know you do well, keep the students and staff safe in the district.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
After the break, I'm going to offer some thoughts on the history of ransomware, from where it began to where we are today. Stay right there. We'll be right back. This is 760 WJR.
School Talks on WJR is sponsored by Wakely Associates, Point Moran Real Point, Collins and Blaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, and by Clark Construction. Now let's get back to class. Once again, your host, former Superintendent Dr. Robert Livernoy.
I'm sure you'll join me in recognizing that our guests today on the program, Nick Petroni and Shai Hardin, have given us a lot to think about in terms of ransomware, its effect on schools, and ultimately people's privacy when it comes to data and information. And in conducting research for this program, I learned that in late 2024, very late December, PowerSchool, the student records management system that manages most of the data in school districts, at least in Southeast Michigan and across the country, they notified their clients that they were a victim of a ransomware attack, but they didn't experience it officially, but the company was extorted into paying a financial sum to prevent the hackers from leaking the stolen data. And PowerSchool went on to share with their clients that they're working with a cybersecurity technology company to monitor the public domain to make sure that none of this data was and will not be reshared. And most important, they're obviously working with federal agencies to identify the actors involved. And if this doesn't shine a light on the whole picture and issue of ransomware, I don't know what does, because when you have large companies such as financial institutions, large department stores, and others who are paying ransom to protect their data, we are truly at a precipice when it comes to technology and people's privacy. So in discovering this issue that happened with PowerSchool, I went on a little research journey to try to understand what the history of ransomware is, which, believe it or not, dates all the way back to 1989. If you recall, in the 80s, the AIDS epidemic was worldwide, the acquired immune deficiency syndrome, and it was obviously receiving an incredible amount of attention and press. And the first known ransomware attack happened when a doctor created a floppy disk labeled AIDS information that targeted attendees of an AIDS conference. And on the floppy disk was a virus that encrypted file names, and it demanded that the person send $189 to a particular P.O. box in Panama to restore access to the computer that was affected. So think of this. This is 1989. A doctor, a biologist, creates the floppy disk, passes it out at a conference that's being held to try to combat one of the most deadly diseases to affect our world. And in that, passes out a floppy disk that has what we now know is the first ransomware, where a virus locks up your computer, and the only way you get it unlocked is to send $189 to a P.O. box. Back then, I also learned that encryption was very weak And in response to that, and in the years that followed, researchers quickly created tools to decrypt the files. And by the time we got to the 2000s, which sounds like a long time ago from 1989, but it's probably a little bit more than a decade or so, there was a new wave, I guess what we would call early modern ransomware. It was a new wave of ransomware called GP code that surfaced that used stronger encryption algorithms. But these early versions were still relatively unsophisticated compared to what we have now. And if you compare that with my point earlier, we have ultra-sophisticated systems now, but we're still having companies and organizations paying ransomware to protect people's privacy after data has been stolen. And back in the early 2000s, the vehicle of choice for ransomware was the use of email as a delivery mechanism for spreading the ransomware. By late 2009 and into early 2010s, a new thing developed where ransomware as a service became a tool. It was kind of the rise of dark web marketplaces and anonymous payment methods like Bitcoin enabled ransomware creators to distribute their tools to others. So not only do we have a set of bad actors, we're now having them create and distribute their tools to others who can then create ransomware. And this, in the early 2010s, my research showed me that this really marked the birth of ransomware as a service model, where developers were providing ransomware to less skilled attackers for a share of the profits if and when companies paid the ransom. So through the 2010s, we get to around 2013, something known as Crypto Locker marked a significant shift in ransomware because it introduced advanced encryption methods and the use of Bitcoin for ransom payments. And it spread via malicious email attachments and infected hundreds of thousands of computers globally, generating millions of dollars in ransom payments. And by the late 2010s, around 2017, two more high-profile ransomware concepts developed. One is known as WannaCry, which used what was known as the Eternal Blue exploit and affected systems worldwide, including hospitals and businesses. The other was one known as NotPetya, which initially thought to be ransomware, turned out to be some other form of malware that disguised itself as ransomware. And not to overrun you with technical terms and whatnot, but this history I found to be fascinating as it leads right up to where we are today, which is in the 2020s, where we sit now. Ransomware, without a doubt, has become a global threat. The sophistication and targeting of the attacks on critical infrastructure, healthcare systems, and governments is happening all over the world. And attackers often use these double extortion tactics where they not only demand payment to decrypt the data, but they also say, pay us or we'll leak the data. And that's what I think most of us are experiencing now when you're notified that your data has been part of a breach, as they call it. So it's sort of this double extortion tactic where they demand payment not only to decrypt the data so you can get it back and take care of it, but also pay us the money so we don't leak the stolen data online. And I can tell you that there are several key factors that have enabled ransomware. One is the anonymity of cryptocurrency. So the rise of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies made it easier for attackers to receive payments without being easily tracked. And for you listeners who remember back in the day when you had to write a check at the grocery store, you had your name, address, oftentimes they'd ask you for your driver's license number, and you would issue that check to the cashier with all of your information on it in order to get your groceries. Compare that now to this anonymity of cryptocurrency. There are things moving all over that allow people to communicate and exchange payments that have virtually no evidence trail attached to it, or very difficult to, in fact, track that down. The other part that really enables ransomware, and this is especially productive now that everyone has a smartphone, is the ease of distribution from phishing emails to malicious websites, all kinds of software vulnerabilities. All of this are commonly exploited for spreading ransomware. And finally, although this is somewhat, I wouldn't say dated, but the whole interconnectivity across the globe, the way that we all rely upon one another through digital systems across industries, has dramatically increased not only the opportunities for the attackers, but the vulnerabilities for the companies, corporations, and organizations. So ransomware, without a doubt, has now evolved into this multi-billion dollar criminal enterprise. And although it's a difficult topic to discuss, it's worthy for all of us to pay attention to, given its effect on our data. And there's no doubt at all, it's a persistent and evolving threat with new tactics, tools, and targets emerging regularly. And we should all be thankful for having technology experts like Nick Petroni and Shai Harden, who joined us on the program today, who are constantly at the forefront of this, trying to stay ahead of the attackers in order to protect not only student data and privacy, but a host of others. So finally, the future of ransomware, I'm sure you will join me, is very concerning because the threat, as I said, continues to evolve, not only in complexity and scale, but impact. And however it will likely be shaped in the future, I can assure you that the continued advances in technology and how people respond will certainly be part of what the future holds. And some predictions that I found for the global future of ransomware include, as I mentioned, the increased sophistication of the attacks. And to talk about artificial intelligence and automation is an entirely different topic. I shouldn't say different, but certainly one that warrants its own discussion. The other future is the growth of ransomware as a service, as I mentioned, where you now have people creating it and selling it to others so that they too can become a bad actor. And then, as I mentioned, the continued targeting of critical infrastructures is something that increasingly will be of concern across all the big sectors like healthcare, education, energy, transportation, and so on. So with that, although it's a difficult topic, ransomware certainly is something to keep our eye on, especially as it relates to schools and the privacy of student data. And that's all the time we have for today. I'd like to thank our security and technology experts for joining us on the program today. Shai Harden, cybersecurity expert from Warren, Michigan, and Nick Petroni, the Director of Information Systems for Warren Consolidated Schools. That's all the time we have, but remember, there are two ways to spell one and three ways to spell two. Till next time, this has been School Talks on 760 WJR.